counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Kenneth Auerbach, and today I represent Glenn Bullock, appealing his conviction in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. The issue before the court is whether or not the district court erred by determining that the stop and search and seizure of Mr. Bullock was proper under the Fourth Amendment and cases construing it. It's our position that the officer had no reasonable, articulable suspicion to detain Mr. Bullock after the initial record check of his driving record, no outstanding citations, no warrants, and that any subsequent action was therefore illegal.
That he didn't have a registration for the car and didn't know the name of the owner.
Well, he knew the first name, but
he didn't know the name of the owner.
Gave him a first name. He had a valid license.
Would it have been reasonable for the officer to let that car go without further inquiry under those circumstances?
Well, there was nothing more to inquire. He gave what information he knew, and there was nothing more to be done.
What would have been the likely result if the car had been stolen and the officer had let it go under that circumstance?
Excuse me? I'm sorry.
If the officer had let it go and it had been stolen, do you think people would think the officer acted reasonably to let it go without any further inquiry because the thief told me all he knew about it?
Well, but the car had not been reported stolen or missing.
There's bound to be an interval between the time a car is stolen and the time it's reported stolen, isn't there?
There is indeed,
yeah.
But.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
When the police pulled Mr. Bullock over, he had made an illegal turn. Mm-hmm. So there's no question that the stop ordering him to pull over into the parking lot of Kentucky Fried Chicken place was proper. The interpretation given by the district court used that fact as one of many facts to suggest that there was reasonable suspicion even at that point that Mr. Bullock was armed and dangerous. The officer testified that Bullock did not attempt to flee, but that he didn't pull over soon enough. Good Hope Road, being a substantial highway, is entirely reasonable that Bullock would not have pulled off onto the sideway, onto the shoulder of a busy highway, and more reasonable that he would wait and get to a parking lot where there'd be no issue of officer safety or his own safety. When the officer pulled Mr. Bullock over, when he got into the parking lot, Bullock's pants were unzipped, his hands were in his lap. The officer had seen Bullock appellant eating food while he was driving. He was no longer eating food. Bullock answered all of the officer's questions. His hands were always in view. Now, the officer did say that in his testimony that there was some sudden gestures or he moved his hands down to his side, but there was nothing furtive about it. That word never appeared in any of the transcripts. There was never any sudden movements his pants, unzipped though they might have been. No sudden movements to anyone else in the car or any other part of the car. The police officer walked backwards, keeping Bullock in sight. He watched him all the while. He was radioing in for information.
Don't you think this is an extremely dangerous situation for an officer, this kind of stop? Someone's got their pants unzipped. I mean, it could be contraband, but it could easily be a weapon. I mean, it happens all the time. One officer a week is killed in the United States in a traffic stop or pursuit.
I think the cases are clear and the opinions are clear that this is a dangerous situation, but the fact that we have a traffic stop and that it is potentially dangerous must be analyzed in the context of what actually happened, what facts were objectively reasonable to the officer. While I know there's some dispute whether we should be engaging in what I think, as the government calls it, an atomistic analysis of each and every act that the officer testifies to as to what generated the suspicion. The fact is that when you look at the cases, that's sort of what we do, what this court does and what other courts.
There was initially suspicion of a traffic offense, and then suspicion develops, as Judge Santel mentioned, that the car might have been stolen, so further inquiries warranted. In the course of conducting that further inquiry, it's certainly reasonable under the cases, isn't it, for the officer to protect himself?
It is if he can point to reasonable, objective facts. And what we're suggesting is Bullock had done nothing except make that illegal left turn and possibly driving.
An illegal left turn, when the officer gets there, his top of his pants are undone. It's not just unzipped. The top of
undone.
His pants are undone, potentially because he's hiding something. And in fact, it turns out he was hiding something.
But his hands are always in view.
The pants are undone.
Right.
He can't give a name for the owner of the car other than to give some first name. He doesn't have any documentation of ownership. I question what you're saying when you say the facts are we do this atomistic analysis and look at each element separately. The oldest and most used cliche in Fourth Amendment law is totality of the circumstances.
That's correct.
We don't, let's say, each one individual circumstance, let's say the totality of the circumstances.
And let's look at all of the circumstances in this case. His hands are always in view. The officer receives no information from central information, whatever, the dispatcher, that there's any problem with the car. The officer then comes back to the car, and by this time, two other officers have bicycled up to assist. His hands are still in view. His pants are now zipped. The officer has watched the appellant while he's been doing the radio and getting the radio information. At least that was his testimony at the hearing. So he has not seen any activity on the part of Bullock to generate suspicion of armed and dangerousness.
Are you going to deal with the government's point that at the suppression hearing, the defense attorney, wasn't you, was it?
No, it was not.
Said, I'm not going to argue that the police couldn't pat him down.
Well, I looked at that and I couldn't understand what counsel was arguing. But the judge then made rulings of findings of fact and conclusions of law about that. So I felt that it was proper for me to make this argument that they had gone on to make those rulings.
But the judge wouldn't necessarily do that if it's a conceded issue, and then the judge says I find that there was articulable suspicion here. He doesn't have to add, and the defense attorney conceded that, but the defense attorney here did.
What?
So why, I don't understand why that issue, the entire argument you're making seems to me to be, have been forfeited in the district court.
I have no response to that.
Can I ask a question, which is, one of the purposes or results, not purposes, of our Fourth Amendment case law is to give guidance to officers on the street and in these kinds of circumstances. What, in your view, would justify an officer in pulling someone out of a car in suspicion of a stolen car situation?
Well, the case law would suggest that if there's some reasonable...
What else? What else
is needed? Specific facts.
Such as
furtive gestures. Did he hide his hands? Did he make movements into his pants area? Did he make a sudden movement into the console?
Didn't you tell us a moment ago that his pants were unfastened and later they were fastened?
Yes.
So he did make a hand gesture in the area then?
Well, he zipped up his pants, yes.
You couldn't have done that without putting his hands down.
Right.
Excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead with your answer to Judge.
But the police officer, when he was making his when he was testifying, made those points, and yet his hands are, like I said, there's no furtive gestures, there's no hidden movements here, there's no reaching into the console, which I'm sure you've seen in many of the other cases, reaching under the seat of the car, all of
the fear here was not of the potential weapon being in the console or under the seat. The fear was it was down in his pants,
and
that's the area he reached to.
And his seats, and I believe the officer also testified that the seat belt had been locked. So that, I mean, he's now belted in and zipped up, making it even more difficult if there is any weapon in his pants for him to have access to it.
Is driving without a registration an offense in the District of Columbia?
I believe it is.
It is. And in order to enforce that, what does a police officer have to do?
He has to determine that the car is, in fact, unregistered.
No. If you're driving without your registration, is that an offense in the District of Columbia?
I believe it is.
Yeah, I think it is. And what happens when you're caught doing that?
You're usually given a citation.
A citation. And in order to write a citation, what does the officer have to do?
Pull out a citation book, get a pencil, and write.
And write.
And that write the and, name.
And while he's writing, what is the occupant of the car doing?
Presumably sitting there.
He'll just be sitting there. And this gentleman had so in order to protect oneself, isn't it prudent for the police officer, if he's going to write a citation, and this guy certainly deserved one, to first pat him down?
Yes, but the,
okay.
But
isn't that the end of the case then? I mean, even though I think you've waived this whole argument, isn't that the end of it?
I don't believe so, because at the point that he's made that decision, after he's received the information, the testimony and the hearing was that two other officers came up to assist, so now there are three officers on the scene. So he's got the ability to write his citation, knowing full well that there are two other officers
who might get, who might also get shot.
Well, who are watching Mr. Yeah. the appellant.
Okay, Counselor, your time is up. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it. We'll hear from the governor.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States. The judgment of the district court should be affirmed, both because appellant has waived the specific grounds upon which he urges reversal to this court, and because as a matter of substantive Fourth Amendment law, the district court correctly determined that the police officer had a reasonable articulable suspicion to believe that the appellant was armed.
Are the police entitled to do an automatic frisk when the suspected crime is stolen car?
No, Your Honor. There still needs to be a reasonable articulable suspicion that the potential offender might be armed.
And
I don't believe that under, I think it says too much to assume that because a vehicle is stolen that necessarily a weapon is involved, but that we have so much more than that here, the combination of the officer believing that the defendant first attempted to flee from him by making the abrupt turn, the eye contact, the nervousness, the repeated hand gestures, the furtive movements, that in combination.
Doesn't everyone who's pulled over have some element of nervousness?
Yes, they do.
And so then the frisk will always be justified because the officer can always say, well, they were shifting their eyes, or in another case they'll say, well, they were staring directly at me. I mean, there's always going to be something.
I agree that nervousness generally is a common feature of a traffic stop, but this court's cases have held most recently as in Spinner that you need more than the nervousness, and we have more than the nervousness here. We have the nervousness, we have the stolen vehicle, we have the repeated hand movements towards open pants, which again is significant because as the court has already noted, it's very capable of concealing a weapon within the open pants, and indeed the officer testified that not only is it in his experience unusual to see somebody driving with their pants open, but the few times that he has encountered somebody driving in such a fashion, they turned out to be armed. So we not only have facts that as an objective matter would cause a reasonable person to believe that they were dealing with an armed individual, but we have the officer's own experience that led him to believe that this person might be armed.
So if the pants had been zipped up here and there had been no hand movement, then the officer couldn't have pulled them out of the car?
It would have been a closer case. The government is not saying that every time somebody puts their hands in their lap, you have a furtive gesture. But in this case, we have open pants, which is, you know, very unusual, and the belt is also opened. So that coupled with the indicia that a crime is potentially in progress, the nervousness, the attempts to, the officer didn't say flee from his presence, but certainly the driving for an extra block can reasonably be viewed as buying the suspect time during which anything might have been going on in the passenger compartment.
You mentioned something about high crime area or medium crime area.
Yes, the officer testified that he had patrolled this particular patrol service area for the last 3 years, and that in his experience, this was
Are there maps of what are the high crime areas?
Particularly medium to high crime.
Yeah.
I've seen lots of high crime areas.
Medium to high.
The first one I've seen, it was a medium to high crime.
He's a discriminating officer. It's I think it's actually to his credit that he didn't try to overblow the situation, and I think it's also to his credit that he didn't immediately haul the appellant out of the car and frisk him. He took his time. He evaluated the circumstances and responded to a situation that he deemed worthy of a frisk. And certainly, you know, the circumstances were so compelling as described by the trial court testimony that defense counsel said he wasn't going to argue that they couldn't pat him down. And that is the government's first reason for why this court should, in fact, deny the appeal.
Well, the argument was he should have never been brought out of the car in the first place because the reasonable suspicion had dissipated once the check on the car had been done.
I think that is a gloss that has been added on appeal. Below, the defense counsel started by saying that he, much as appellant does here, that the government was giving the most sinister interpretation to facts that could be viewed in a benign fashion. And when he received a question, and persistent questioning, in fact, from Judge Walton as to the reasonableness of an officer accepting the fact that a driver of a car doesn't know the registered owner and has no registration, he then moved on to the part about where the appellant was brought out of the car, and he led off his discussion of what happened during the frisk by saying, I'm not going to argue that they couldn't pat him down, and immediately focused that the search was too broad within the meaning of Terry, that there was an excessive searching for the purposes for which the pat-down started. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes if you need it, counsel.
I think I'd yield back the balance of my time.
I'm sorry?
I'd yield back the balance of my
time. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Arbuck, you were appointed to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your service to the court and to the country.